and welcome to 251, two pianists, five podcasts, one subject. My name is Nick Tomlin.
And I'm Simon Whiteside, and today's podcast is about Sonny Clarke, a sideman. Originally, we were going to go with five leaders: Buddy DeFranco, Sonny Criss, Hank Mobley, Grant Green, and Dexter Gordon. But the podcast became very long, nearly 2 hours. So we decided to cut it down to just three. You can hear the full version on our Patreon page. Over to you, Nick.
In the last podcast, we just gave a brief overview of his life and career. So he spent his early life near Pittsburgh, but moved to the West Coast in around about 1951, when he was about 20 years old. And he very soon began playing with prominent musicians on the West Coast, probably most notably Wardell Gray and Art Pepper. He recorded with Art Pepper and Buddy DeFranco, who we're going to go on to talk a bit more about in this episode. He then moved in about 1956, 57. He moved to the East Coast, settled in New York, and started a recording relationship with Blue Note Records. And he recorded with a host of the greatest musicians of the time, most notably Hank Mobley, Dexter Gordon, Grant Green. And we're going to be talking again about those musicians a bit later in this podcast. He died tragically very young. He was only 31 when he died of a heart attack, but it was really brought about by drug misuse, which had sort of plagued his life, really.
Yes, and it's interesting to note that in his short life, I mean, his working life was really from when he was 20 until he was 31. He recorded 57 albums, 11 as leader. If you compare that with a prolific current jazz musician, I looked up Brad Maldo's output. At the age of 31, he'd recorded 42 albums and 13 as leader. And just if you think about how well-known Brad Maldo is, really, in this time, and in some respects how little-known Sonny Clarke is, it's quite an amazing comparison. Anyway, onward and upward.
So the first musician that we're going to look at that Sonny Clarke had a sort of significant musical relationship with was Buddy DeFranco. Buddy DeFranco was a clarinetist. He was born in New Jersey but raised in Philadelphia, and was one of the few specialist bebop clarinet players. In the early 1940s, the saxophone really became the primary jazz instrument in a way. But Buddy DeFranco continued with a clarinet and really made it a bebop instrument. So he joined Count Basie in about 1950, but by the early 50s, he was actually putting together his own band, and that's where Sonny Clarke comes into the picture.
Yes, it is an interesting character, Buddy DeFranco. He, just like Sonny with his real name, Conrad Yates Clarke, Buddy DeFranco's full name is Boniface Ferdinand Leonard DeFranco.
Wow.
Quite a mouthful. So you can see why people call him Buddy. but yeah, he was very influential on Sonny Clarke's early development as a pianist and as a player. And we're going to talk about a couple of tunes, aren't we, in more detail.
Mm.
But there are quite a lot of things we can talk about. And in fact, our first version of this podcast, we went on for nearly 40 minutes talking about Buddy DeFranco. That's going to be available only to our Patreon page for the longer version. And also we'll be putting on How Deep Is the Ocean transcription of Introduction and Solo of Sonny Clarke onto that resource. So Patreon is an arts support platform, and we have to thank London Jazz News, who did a little article on our podcast in a recent edition of goes on their website and in their newsletter, and they mentioned our Patreon page, and that's definitely how we got our first Patreon supporter, and much thanks to him, because it helps us pay for our production costs of the podcast. So this is going to be a slightly shorter version about our his relationship to Buddy DeFranco. Are there any tunes from the three or more albums, sort of really kind of five albums-ish worth of material, isn't there?
Mm.
But they were sort of chopped up and put in different orders from different mm-hmm. sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any particular tunes that you think are important to mention before we go into the two that we're going to talk in detail about?
It's interesting that the very first session, the album that became Jazz Tones, features actually two different bands. So the first band is Kenny Drew, Milt Hinton, Art Blakey and Buddy DeFranco. And the second band on that album is Sonny Clark, Gene Wright and Bobby White. And so really what happened was Buddy DeFranco put this band together with Art Blakey and Milt Hinton, Kenny Drew, but it kind of broke up very quickly. I think probably because Art Blakey went on to put together the Jazz Messengers and so Clark joined along with Gene Wright and Bobby White. And most of the tracks were recorded with that lineup, although Tal Farlow joined them on some of the sessions later on.
2.5 years doesn't really seem like that long in terms of a relationship. You know, if you look at, say, Brubeck's band, which was pretty much, and then there's a crossover there, isn't there, with the bass player, of course.
Yeah, sure.
But it doesn't seem, 2.5 years doesn't seem an enormous amount of time with a band. But in reality, that's a hell of a lot of playing at that time of jazz history. And they made a load of recordings. They did a lot of touring.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, they must have played together a lot.
Yeah, and Sonny Clark's first experience of going to Europe and things came around that time through Buddy DeFranco. So it's quite interesting how that did develop. And it's that album that you're talking about is sort of a transition, isn't it, between, or maybe an audition almost, if you like, what's going to work. And then nearly 3 years worth of time on the road and recording.
Yeah.
Because he was very busy, Buddy DeFranco. There's no doubt about it. He was a Norgran artist, wasn't he, to start with? Or Clef and Norgran, all those pre-Verve album labels that Norman Granz had. And he was a big promoter of mixed-race bands, for a start. It can't be... That has to be said, really, that he was way ahead of some people in getting the bands to be racially mixed and performing at the same, you know, allowed to enter through the same door and eat at the same table and get the same money and all those sorts of things. And Buddy DeFranco was very in with Norma Grant's, and his entire career really was propped up by that, wasn't it?
And it's interesting, just focusing a bit more on Sonny Clark's playing, I think this is very much a kind of formative period. I think you can sort of hear influences and traits in Buddy Clark's playing at this time, which he goes on to develop later. But I don't think he's not really a fully formed player. I mean, he's still an amazing player. But comparing it, I don't know how you feel about this, comparing it with some of the later albums, the Blue Note albums. On the faster tempos, sometimes his time is a little bit kind of, he's not quite on top of it. For me, he plays a lot more licks and kind of bluesy kind of quotes, which he doesn't really do so much of later.
I agree. Yeah. I think you're right. I think of the Buddy DeFranco period as his sort of college days.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was in his 20s.
Yeah, he was really young. That's the thing. He was,
20 to 25, yeah. I mean, I think either of us would love to have played as well as that when we were 20.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That thing happens, doesn't it, with players where all of their influences are pretty obvious when they first record.
Mm.
So, Miles Davis sounds like Dizzy Gillespie in his earliest recordings, and then moves on to sound like Miles Davis. Yeah. And if you carry that forward, you could say that, to a certain extent, Wynton Marsalis sounds a bit like Miles Davis when he does his first recordings and then becomes Wynton Marsalis. And I think Sonny definitely, his Bud Powell influence and his Art Tatum influence, maybe Teddy Wilson's in there, isn't it, early on?
Yeah, yeah.
And the fragments are not integrated, really.
Yeah.
But by the end of his career, they are.
Yeah, sure. I mean, particularly Bud Powell. I mean, obviously, he's the overriding influence. He was on most, I think, most jazz piano players around this time, sort of early 50s. And it's very, very obvious in, very evident in Sonny's playing around this time.
Yeah.
But the two tracks...
You couldn't really get away from things like The Amazing Bud Powell was as an album and... You know, I think Blue Note recorded him in 1941, which is only 2 years after they established, and kept recording him as much as possible, even through to the 60s.
He was a huge influence, but going on to talk, we sort of both picked out these two tunes. Interestingly, we both sort of picked originals, didn't we? I mean, most of the repertoire they were recording were standards. But Sonny does get a bit of space, doesn't he, to show off his compositional.
Yeah, it's interesting actually because there's another tune called Cable Car, which I think he wrote, which comes in this period, which is possibly a blues. I can't remember exactly now, but it's got that very bebop-y feeling to it as well. But of course, the thing is that he starts out writing blueses and rhythm changes, which a lot of people do as a early vehicle for tune writing, don't they?
Yeah.
And a way of playing a rhythm changes and getting the royalties, I suppose.
Yeah.
In a way, also. But Sonny's idea, which I chose, is a rhythm changes, but you kind of wouldn't know it until the blowing, would you?
No.
In a way. And it has some sort of Bobby Timmons-like... almost like moaning. It predates moaning, of course, but it's got some sort of
call and response kind of thing.
Yeah, call and response and sort of some repeated bluesy sort of figurations in the melody. And the bridge is, you know, nothing like a normal rhythm changes bridge, is it? So it seems to show Sonny's penchant for reharmonizing either one note by going around a pattern in a cycle of fifths or perhaps a phrase. So in this case, it's a repeated phrase going to a single note.
Yeah.
And some of the chords, we had a little bit of difficulty with one of the chords because it's harmonized due to the logic of the progression, but the melody's due to the logic of the melody, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's very sophisticated, isn't it? I mean, that particularly the bridge, it really is quite a sophisticated harmony. You know, it's very sort of progressive, really.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to say Buddy DeFranco was quite keen on progressive stuff, and it wasn't his most progressive albums with Sonny Clark. He did do some pretty out there stuff in his career.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously Sonny Clark solo on it is, it does show his influences. And in fact, even in the writing, that bit at the end of the bridge, is, you know, you can hear that in Bud Powell's tunes and in his soloing. And, of course, Bud Powell would have these things. So he'd do, like, Sure Enough and tunes like that. They'd have these almost unrelated sections before, wouldn't they? They'd have a minor-y thing leading into a prequel to the rhythm changes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that probably affected Sonny's writing. And also... probably the sort of he uses the dominant pedal quite a lot, doesn't he? In his left hand, while sort of underpinning sections of the tune, even when they go into the changes, it's not just on sections which are over the five. And the other tune we chose, so that was on an album. Which album did that come on, actually? Sweet Mellow in a mellow mood,
I think.
And the one Mo that you picked up on was from Sweet and Lovely, but it might well have been recorded very similar time.
I think so, because the Sweet and Lovely album has Tal Farlow on guitar, but this this Mo tune actually was just a quartet, and I think it was probably recorded at an earlier session, and they sort of included a couple of tracks on the album. And it's it's a really, really interesting tune. Again, as soon as I heard it, it kind of just leaps out at you as something kind of quite fresh and unusual in the rest of the kind of repertoire. Kind of reminded me a bit of Tad Dameron, if anybody knows Tad Dameron's kind of compositional style, using these kind of cyclic progressions. So it's kind of based on this kind of cyclic cycle of fifths progression, and it's a yeah. really interesting tune, really, really good tune.
And it's very sophisticated chord sequence, isn't it? And I think, in fact, in some respects, compared to the rest of that period, it does give, I think, all of them a little bit of a more difficulty in while soloing.
Yeah, yeah, getting a bit more to think about.
I think Buddy DeFranco, although fluent on it, he isn't as fluent as on other tunes. I don't, you know, he doesn't quite get the melody the first time. He leaves a little bit out,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And then even Sonny's solo, he's hampered a bit by that sort of almost descending.
Yeah, it's a tricky bass line. Sequence. I mean, it would be, you know, it's a tricky sequence to solo over.
However, he also then throws in some other sort of curveballs, which is that ending is really.
Yeah, it's a really unusual ending.
Unusual. And a very rare appearance of a bass solo in the Buddy DeFranco
oeuvre. Yeah.
It's almost like a little bit of bass solo leading us out.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. It's quite. I mean, it sort of works, but it's an unusual ending. You know, I can't think of many tunes that really end. So, I mean, basically, just kind of slows. It just switches to a completely different. It's not even half time, is it? It goes to a different sort of time.
No, it's sort of somewhere near quarter time.
Yeah, yeah.
But it isn't quite quarter time either.
Yeah.
But they seem to manage it fluidly, don't they?
Yeah.
This doesn't fall over while doing
no.
that.
I mean, if you want to listen to any of these tunes that we're talking about, we've released some playlists both on Apple Music and also on Spotify, and I think on YouTube as well.
I did a YouTube one.
Yeah,
and there you can see those on our Facebook pages, Twitter feeds, Instagram, those sorts of thing. Check those out. I think the only other thing we probably need to say about his time with Buddy DeFranco is that it was a sort of a safe place to learn for him.
Mm.
Buddy DeFranco obviously had a very strong image. He had very strong ideas of how, you know, it was the Buddy DeFranco show, wasn't
yeah,
it? There's
absolutely.
No doubt that it's all about him and his rhythm section support all that. So the bass player plays four on a bar pretty solidly. The drummer doesn't comp too frenetically on his snare drum. Mm. It's almost like ride cymbal and closing hi-hat most of the time. All very propulsive, very accurate, very...
Yeah, they're very tight. You know, it's a very tight rhythm section.
And it swings.
Yeah.
But it doesn't get in the way of the main act, which is obviously Buddy's absolutely incredible technical clarinet playing.
Mm.
Mark Crooks, I spoke to, British clarinet player, who just said he does it so well, doesn't sound like it's difficult, but he guarantees to me that it is almost impossible. And he played very high, very fast, very loud, almost like a sort of trumpeter in that bebop sort of faster, higher, louder sort of approach.
Well, maybe that's why, you know, maybe not so many people did it, because it was probably really hard. You know, it may not just be a stylistic thing.
No, absolutely. Mm. We're going to move on now to talk about Grant Green and Sonny Clark after his move to the East Coast.
So the next person we're going to talk about is Grant Green. Grant Green was a guitarist. He was born June the 6th, 1935, in St. Louis, in Missouri. And his sort of earliest experience was playing with a gospel group. And he then started recording in St. Louis with people like Jimmy Forrest and Elvin Jones. Actually, he recorded quite early on with Elvin Jones. His first session for Blue Note, which actually Sonny Clark played on some of that session, was actually shelved. and it was only released later. But he actually went on to do more than over 100 sessions for Blue Note. I think he was the most recorded musician, I think I'm right in saying that. That obviously includes as a sideman and as a leader.
I mean, it's quite interesting how much of his material wasn't released. And the stuff with Sonny Clark seemed to have suffered the most, which was weird. I don't know if it's because it was recorded right at the end of Sonny Clark's life. And I know that the Dexter Gordon stuff, which was also recorded in a similar period, that came out, you know, was at least a year later than, if not 2 years later than it was recorded, that it came out. So maybe they just sort of forgot about it, really, because they were no longer able to record Sonny Clark for future stuff. I'd be interested to know. I don't know if there's a way of us finding out whether Sonny Clark had any recordings in the book, as it were, for Blue Note, or whether it was a bit more of a, we're going to do a recording, who should we get? It's Thursday, we need them on Saturday type approach, or whether it was a bit more planned. I mean, Grant Green was I went through a period of really investigating jazz guitarists. And I think Sonny Clark was really good at playing with other rhythm section players. So we chose two tunes. You chose to talk about Moon River. This is where we've moved from the Hackensack studio to Rudy Van Gelder's purpose-built Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey studio. And for audiophiles out there, I think you can really hear the difference between the styles in the recordings. If you're interested in the sort of sonic quality. So Rudy Van Gelder, I think he's a third member of what made Blue Note amazing. Well, perhaps a fourth member if we also include Reed Miles as a sort of art director, because he brought a clarity to jazz recordings which really isn't there before the 50s. And even isn't, you know, some of the prestige recordings, for example, they don't have so much space in them somehow. The space really developed when he moved to Englewood Cliffs, because before that, as we've said, he was playing, he was using his parents' house. And when he built his studio, some people thought it was a church that he was building, because it was quite high. And the roof of that building, which is still a studio today, you know, it's a pitched roof, but it is empty, if you like. It goes up to the rafters, and it's got quite a lot of space around it. And I think you can really hear the clarity in those recordings from when they moved over to that building. So what would you like to say about Moon River?
Well, it's kind of interesting because, as you hinted at earlier, it's one of the tunes that is normally recorded in 3/4. Moon River is normally a kind of a waltz, but they do it in a kind of medium 4 swing, which actually works really well. And I kind of nicked this, so if I do trio gigs, I occasionally do Moon River like this, because I think it works really nicely with this kind of feel. I was really interested in Sonny Clark's solo, because it's a really good example of the way he's thinking melodically and sort of intervallically. So what's really interesting about this tune is there's this kind of descending fifth in the tune. I'm not going to even attempt to sing it, but there is kind of a descending fifth, and he picks it out. So if you listen to the recording, as Simon said, a lot of this stuff is available on these playlists we created. So when Grant Green plays the tune, Sonny Clark sort of picks out this descending fifth. Mm. He does it every single time in the head. He sort of picks it up.
It's like an echo, isn't it?
And like an echo of the phrase that Grant Green plays. And then when he goes into his solo, he uses this descending fifth interval really as the basis of his solo. So he starts his solo with this descending fifth, and then he sort of develops it around, and he keeps sort of coming back to this descending fifth interval. It's a beautiful example of a motivic development is what it would be called. And also interestingly, in the intro, he also uses, I don't know if this was intentional, it probably was, but he plays this descending fifth like little ostinato figure with his left hand. So the whole thing is really based on this descending fifth interval, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, that's something I also spotted in, particularly in the when he's comping in the tune, picking that stuff out. Mm. But it did actually remind me of the famous Freddie Freeloader solo in a way. That kind of the way that Wynton Kelly in that solo has makes a lot of very small number of ideas and develops them. I think it's that's something which happens. Sonny Clark does in this tune. He's got something sort of in his head which he's playing with it. He's sort of rearranging.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can really hear, you can almost hear him thinking. You know, it's fascinating. To hear him sort of, and it's very obvious that he's. It's intentional. It's intentional that he's using this.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, it's about playing the tune, isn't it? And soloing on the tune and not.
Yeah, and it all refers back to the tune, you know, which is where he gets it from.
Exactly.
Initially.
And I think some players, the tune is just something that gets in the way of them soloing. and I mean, you can say that of Charlie Parker, really. I mean, and if you think about it, all of his famous tunes aren't really tunes. They're improvisations that have stuck, if you like. So things like Moose the Moosh are, you know, so rhythm changes. It's got a head which he plays the same on different recordings, but not quite the same. And it's almost no different from what happens when he starts soloing, in a way. So... Whereas here with Sonny Clark, he's really obviously engaged with what melody he's playing. I think there's I know that Dexter Gordon, who we'll talk about next, was a big exponent of knowing the melody of the tune and knowing the words that the song has, so that I mean, I heard that in, for example, in the Sonny Chris stuff, he's playing a tune and he's embellishing. So that you can almost not hear the tune sometimes when he's playing the head, if you like. He's doing that thing of suggesting the tune rather than stating the tune. Certainly, I don't think, you know, there's a merit in that to a certain extent. But Dexter Gordon was very keen on people in his band knowing what the melody was about, what the song was about. I mean, I find his solo on that very fluid, Sonny Clark's solo on Moon River. It's got a very strong start, as you've pointed out, picking that descending fifth. I mean, his comping doesn't change. It's still that shell voicing thing that we've talked about. And he does again stick that bluesy flavour in the very last statement. So he's obviously developed a set of criteria that he is employing, either consciously or unconsciously in his playing.
Yeah. And it also ends with the same kind of cyclic fifth kind of ending again, you know, which I'm sure was probably his, it was probably his idea.
Well, it does seem to come from way back, doesn't it? I mean, there's a lot of the Buddy DeFranco tunes that end that way as well, for example.
Yeah.
It's difficult to know with these sorts of things whether it was idiomatic of the way in which people play tunes. Because, you know, I guess in New York, one of the reasons New York was a powerhouse and has been a powerhouse of jazz is that you are all stuck in a small sort of area of land. And, you know, when 52nd Street was a thing, there were lots of different clubs with lots of great players all on the same street. It's anecdotally suggested that people would... You know, it was more like one gig on the street that people used to wander between. Players would often do their set and then go off to another player's gig and sit in. And so the cross-fertilization of ideas and styles and it's all part of the learning process, wasn't it? And I think perhaps one of the differences between the West Coast period and the East Coast period for Sonny Clark was that way of... You know, it's almost... for want of a better word, stuck with Buddy DeFranco. He was touring with him, he was recording with him, he was playing with him. And it wasn't quite so easy to go from one club to another, particularly after Central Avenue clubs closed in Los Angeles. Whereas in New York, I think he had a lot more of a seedbed, if you like. So the second tune we're going to talk about is Olio, and that was recorded slightly later. That was the very beginning of 1962, wasn't it?
Yes, January.
And Moon River was recorded almost at Christmas. Yeah.
That was just 61. Before Christmas, wasn't it? Yeah.
So it's an interesting approach, isn't it, too? Because it's a rhythm changes, obviously.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
And you said you found, I think when we talked off air, you found a critic writing some liner notes who wasn't convinced that they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, well, I happened to find the original liner notes. I mean, bearing in mind this was released in 1980 or early 80s, I think. I'm not sure who the writer was. But he sort of makes a comment that Grant Green keeps messing up the head of Olio, you know. But of course, he doesn't mess it up. What they're doing is it's a reharmonization, isn't it? It's quite a clever little reharmonization they do of the first four bars. But it is, I mean, I don't know about you, when I first listened to it, I had to, whoa, what happened there? You know, you sort of, it's really quite surprising because you just don't really expect to hear that in the first four bars.
No, basically they kind of start further away, don't they?
They start, I figured out they start in C major and then they do a kind of they go 2-5 into B major and then 2-5 back to B flat. Yeah, so they're kind of descending to the B flat.
I think it comes from that, there's a Charlie Parker Blues that does that, isn't there? Is it Oprah Vav that does that? Where you sort of start higher up than you're meant to and...
And you
cycle
sort of,
back in, which again ties in with this sort of 2-5-1 cycle of fifths sort of approach.
I mean, I would be prepared to stake some money on the fact that was probably Sonny Clark's idea, you know, without wanting to.
I mean, Grant Green's definitely feel player, isn't he? He went on to play quite a lot of funky jazz, didn't he? I mean, I don't mean that in the sort of wah-wah pedal funk. I mean, in the Horace Silver sense of funk.
No.
But also, I think he's one of the most sampled people on the Blue Note catalogue for hip-hop artists who've picked up.
Particularly with his work, because
he had Idris Muhammad on some of his stuff when it gets even more funky towards the end of his career. Quite a lot of those breakbeats have been picked up. I mean, Sonny Solo... The idea that it was a mistake is refuted by the solos because they play the same sequence.
Yeah, because they keep the same sequence.
And it's very fluent, isn't it?
You know,
it's top quality rhythm changes playing, I think.
Yeah, especially as, you know, with that kind of alteration, it becomes really quite tricky to improvise fluidly over, you know, because it's... It's not an easy sequence, is it, really?
It makes something familiar less familiar, which I think is a really, really clever thing to do. I think it shows to us that Sonny Clark was really quite an intelligent player, a thoughtful player.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are some players who have a thing, don't they? They have whatever their thing is, and that is what you associate with them, and they make style doing that. And other players, I'd say Barry Harris was a bit like this too, and maybe Tommy Flanagan. They're people who played with lots of different people and assimilated lots of different information. And it's almost like more integrated. I mean, I'd say Hank Mobley had that in his tenor playing too.
In some ways they're quite similar sorts of players, aren't they, really? Hank Mobley and Sonny Clark.
They did seem to fit quite well together. It's a little surprising that... Well, I guess Hank Mobley's on some of Sonny Clark's leader sessions as well. The favour was repaid.
Yeah.
Do you have anything further to add that we haven't covered?
No, I think that covers it really in terms of those tunes. So next we're going to look at Sonny Clark's work with Dexter Gordon. Dexter Gordon, tenor saxophonist. He was born February the 27th, 1923, in Los Angeles, California. So he was born on the West Coast, started playing clarinet and switched to alto initially. But when he was about 15, he started on the tenor. And while still at school, he played with people like Chico Hamilton, Buddy Collette. And in 1940, he joined Lionel Hampton's band and also played with Louis Armstrong, Billy Eckstein, and was really part of the kind of burgeoning bebop scene in the early 1940s New York. By this time, he'd moved to New York. He sort of had health problems in the 1950s, sort of drug stroke health problems. But by the early 60s, by the time he recorded with Sonny Clark, he was kind of on a bit of a comeback, I would say.
Definitely. I mean, he's an interesting character because he did have a drug issue and he was one of the people who kicked it and managed to... He lived a long life considering his potential.
Yeah.
It was a very big man, 6'5". In fact, one of his biographies is called Long Tall Dexter. And he also had...
That was his kind of nickname, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And, you know, again, he was very much of that sort of sharp-dressed jazz man, bebop sort of stylist. Mm. And he's an interesting character because, of course, most people... His career was really refocused by the film Round Midnight in the 80s.
Mm.
And he kind of plays Lester Young in that film.
Mm. Well, it's sort of cross between Lester Young and Bud Powell, isn't it? Is the sort of I mean, the I suppose the character is more Lester Young, but the story is Bud Powell, and it's kind of a mixture of the two, isn't it?
Well, it came from a book written by a French guy
Francis Poudreau, was it? Poudreau or something?
Yeah. Lady Francis, as he's called.
Yeah.
but he wrote about his relationship with Bud Powell more than Lester Young, really.
Mm.
But so that made Dexter Gordon come back into the public limelight, really, and it refocused his. Certainly, I mean, that's when I was getting into jazz in the 80s, and that, you know, he was a big figure because of that film, really. Although that was later than I discovered him to be. Fair to me, but it brought him right into the public domain again.
Although also, I guess his return after, because he spent quite a lot of time in Europe, didn't he? And then he kind of returned in the 70s, and it was kind of hailed as a sort of home. Well, in fact, he recorded an album called Homecoming, didn't he? Which was quite a big deal when he finally returned to New York.
Yes, and of course, in the film, that return ends in the demise of the character, doesn't it? Because he gets back into drugs, but that's a different kettle of fish, really, with the real story. So we're going to talk about two tunes that Sonny Clark recorded, and they recorded two albums, but in a way, they recorded one album in a sense, didn't they?
Yeah, they were almost, well, in fact, the two sessions were sort of 2 days apart, were they?
Or two days.
Like the next day, wasn't it?
Exactly.
2 days. Yeah, and I mean, the first of those, Go, is, I mean, it's still regarded as one of the greatest jazz albums ever recorded. I mean, it's very often spoken of in the same breath as Kind of Blue or Giant Steps, isn't it? It really is a kind of, it's considered a classic jazz album, really.
And I think one of the things we should say about Sonny Clark's career is that he joined Blue Note at its absolute high point. And I would say that in terms of people's understanding of Blue Note. So Blue Note was always a great record label, no doubt about it. And they recorded, they picked out people who they wanted to record. It wasn't a commercial angled record company. They wanted to record what they liked, what was going on, what they enjoyed, what they heard. But what really made it possible, it's the old thing of what do you support that with? So Reed Miles's cover designs undoubtedly made a huge impact. And, you know, the fact that the first books of jazz album cover art were the Blue Note ones, really, it says a lot. Francis Wolff's being a professional photographer and taking fantastic moody shots, which were included in those album covers, is really important. So the visual side of Blue Note was very important to its success, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we're lucky, I think, that a record company that took that much interest in its covers had even better music on it than the covers, it could be possible. I mean, certainly Blue Note albums have been, the style of Blue Note albums have been copied and reused many times. Yeah. And the music is not necessarily as good as the Blue Note catalogue that's on, and in fact, even the film Motherless Brooklyn, if you see the posters for Motherless Brooklyn, it could be a Blue Note album cover.
Mm. No, it's such an iconic look, isn't it? I mean, it's,
And Sonny Clark was, his years with Blue Note were those years. And the other thing we haven't quite mentioned, which probably opened up an opportunity for him, was that Bud Powell was away from the scene quite a lot.
Mm.
He'd moved off to Paris at some point.
Paris, yeah.
Was it 59 he meant?
Yes, I think something, yeah.
But he was already sort of not being recorded as much from 57, and he had his health problems as well, which were more to do with mental health, weren't they, than the sort of standard drug problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a gap in the market, if you like, and I think these are, for me, these are probably Sonny Clark's, along with his own work late in his life, these are the albums which he is the best on.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So you chose Second Balcony Jump to talk about and focus on.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, he'd actually recorded this, he recorded a version of this, because there was a session before the Go session, wasn't there, in earlier in 1962, which was released later, I think again in about 1980.
Or called Landslide.
Landslide, yeah. And they recorded a few tracks, and Second Balcony Jump was one of the tracks that they recorded on this session.
Mm.
Although I'm not sure it was actually released, Second Balcony Jump. I'm not sure it was. I don't think it was. Was it? There were a few that were actually just not used, and I think that maybe that was one of them.
Well, I'm wondering whether it was a let's do a session, and then they didn't quite get what they wanted from it.
Yeah, so they did. Yes, they did it on the next. And I think that's like, what it was. Yeah,
we really like what you've done, but it needs.
Yeah,
we need to do it again.
Yeah,
much as we have to do with this podcast occasionally.
Yeah. So anyway, Second Balcony Jump. Yeah, it's an old tune, really, written by Gerald Valentine for Earl Hines's band initially, but the version that Dexter plays is based more on the Billy Eckstine version. Billy Eckstine was a band leader in the late 1930s, early 40s, and he became sort of associated with the bebop movement because a lot of the sort of early bebop players passed through his band, including Dexter Gordon.
It's considered the bebop big band. I remember watching a documentary with Billy Eckstine on it, actually, and he read off the, because he was a singer, wasn't he, Billy Eckstine?
Yes.
Lovely voice.
Yeah.
But unfortunately for him, not really recorded at a time when, you know, his voice could be properly represented, I don't think.
No.
But he listed the players in the band, and it was all these amazing players.
Just a who's who of bebop players. Yeah.
And a girl singer, Billie Holiday, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he, at the end of all that long list of people like Dexter Gordon and the like, he just said, you know, no names, which I thought was genius. But Dexter Gordon really, I think he benefited a lot from that period, because he'd been playing in big bands, but he was playing in big bands, you know, the real dance bands, really, weren't they?
Mm. Yes.
I think Billy Eckstine's band is probably one of the first big bands that was not really aimed at dancers as much.
Yeah, yeah.
It was more like a small band with lots of players in it, I suppose.
Yeah.
You'd say.
Yeah.
And that arrangement, you are right, even the kind of the out head which has a...
They do a sort of shout chorus from the arrangement, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's on the Earl Hines version. I think
it's not on the Earl Hines version. No, it isn't. No, I think that was because very often this song is credited to Gerald Valentine and Billy Eckstine. I think because Billy Eckstine kind of rearranged it and almost rewrote it. I think really.
Yeah. And of course, it is essentially a Rhythm Changes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically a Rhythm Changes tune, and like you say, uses this kind of unresolved ending, which I didn't actually pick up that you said that was done earlier on. I can't remember which track it was. No, it was one of the
on the bright track. One, the one that's the a bit like one. The theme.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's another rhythm changes, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And Dexter does one of his sort of classic. I was started to write down some of the quotes. So he quotes Mona Lisa. That was one of his favourite quotes that crops up. My heart stood still. I think he crops up, and there's probably a few others that I didn't.
He chucks in all sorts of things, doesn't he? but the thing about Dexter's quotes are that they're not they don't feel shoehorned in, do they?
No.
They feel really
kind of work.
Yeah, and he'll often develop them out of the potential problem he's going to have. If he quotes a tune that isn't going to fit, by the time he gets to the chords where it's not going to fit, he's adapted the melody to fit.
Much
in the way that Betty Carter would sing a ballad that lasts one chorus, but she sings it over four, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And she makes it all fit together as incredibly clever way.
It's just a brilliant recording, and I like the way Sonny Clark does something which he does a lot. He sort of picks up Dexter Gordon's last phrase, so Dexter Gordon ends his solo. Sonny Clark picks up his phrase and sort of uses that as the basis for his, which he does quite a lot, actually, doesn't he?
It's
another sort of feature of his playing.
I think it comes particularly with those later albums that he's really on top of the...
Yeah, completely, yeah.
The ears are fully open, aren't they? And
Yeah,
and as you say, the last phrase of Dexter Gordon's solo becomes the first phrase of Sonny Clark's, and then he develops it further.
Yeah.
Which is... I think that's just a real feature of his own. It's like he's listening to his own lines and doing that with them. So he's now developed to listening to other people's lines and doing it with that.
Yes, yeah.
That's all I was going to say there.
Yeah. I was just going to say that... I don't know how you feel about this. I just listening to this album, I kind of realised that he's kind of harking back in a lot of ways. I think he was very influenced by the kind of the swing and early sort of bebop period. And it was interesting that, so Cheesecake, which is the first tune on the album, is kind of a bit of a nod to Lester Young's Tickletoe, isn't it? There's a very famous Lester Young tune, Tickletoe, which is kind of sort of the basis of Cheesecake, although he changes it around and there's a bridge and stuff, which... and a lot of the ballads he uses, they're very often from that period, aren't they? They're kind of
older tunes, yeah.
Older tunes. Although I noticed, I don't know, you may know more than me about this, but he seems to very often record ballads that Frank Sinatra sang. I don't know if there was ever any, but I noticed that on this album, for example. So I think the two ballads. So he does. I guess I'll have to hang my tears out to dry.
Mm.
And Where Are You? Were both recorded by Sinatra, they'd only just been, sort of 57, 58, he'd recorded both of those.
Just released.
I don't know if he was influenced I don't know if he was kind of influenced by Frank Sinatra's sort of choice of tunes. I don't know, maybe may have been a coincidence, but...
I do think people, certainly the way my choices of repertoire have developed is that you hear a tune and you want to play it.
Yeah.
And you want to, I play Remember because of Soul Station and...
Yeah,
another great 3/4 tune turned into a 4/4 tune, as we spoke about earlier. Yeah, you do get these tunes that get picked up because they're in the public domain, I suppose.
Yeah. But
I know, as we said already, Dexter Gordon's very keen on knowing the words to songs.
That's the thing. I just wondered whether I could, and the whole way he plays is really, it's very vocal, isn't it? It's like he's singing.
Yeah.
Tune really, and I'm sure he was influenced by singers, a lot.
I mean, the another corollary that you could tie in with Frank Sinatra, although If I'm honest, I think Frank Sinatra's amazing timing that people always talk about is not quite as significant as it's often claimed to be. It's just no disrespect. I think Frank Sinatra was fantastic, but he didn't like to record more than once, did he, if he could help it? Frank Sinatra, he'd go into the studio, he'd sing it, and that would be it. And I think his lateness, if you like, he's not on the beat because he's listening. He's reacting. So that's and I think that's I mean, I think it's purposeful, don't get me wrong, but I don't think I don't think he's doing it. When you hear him sing arrangements he's sung time and time again in concert, he's much more on the beat.
That's interesting.
But on his recordings, he's got that slight lag, with slight lazy lag, which is fantastic. But Dexter Gordon has that in Oodles, doesn't he?
That's what I just wondered. Yeah, no, it just struck me. I don't know whether there was a kind of influence or... Yeah, I don't know, but it's interesting to think about. Anyway.
The thing about Dexter Gordon is he's always late on the beat, but never late. It's one of those people who you can tell the time is ticking in his head.
In the
correct place, and he's choosing... to place himself behind the beat, not keeping up.
Yeah. No, I mean, his time feel is like nobody else's. It's incredible, absolutely. Amazing time. And you were looking at, because you looked at the ballad, the one that recorded earlier, isn't that the Until the Real Thing?
Until the Real Thing comes along.
Which they do on The Swinging Affair, which is the next sort of session they did.
Yeah, and in some respects, although Go is brilliant as well, I do sort of, over time, I've drifted towards liking A Swinging Affair a little bit more. I'm not quite sure why, but I do feel, I do go to that one more as listening. I mean, to be honest, everything we've talked about today, the stuff I listen to the most would probably be the Dexter Gordon stuff. And, you know, and when I say that, I mean, go back to, you know, what should I put on today? Oh, maybe a bit of Dexter Gordon. And Hank Mobley's the same, but not so much the stuff with Sonny Clark, to be honest. His ballad playing is extraordinary, isn't it, Dexter Gordon? He's known
for absolutely.
That.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the best. It's funny, you know, I sort of listen to loads of people, and you sort of put Dexter Gordon on, especially playing a ballad, and sometimes I just sort of think, I don't know if it really gets much better than this. No. I mean, it's a kind of silly thing to say because, of course, you know, he's one, but he was such a great interpreter of ballads and had such a great time feel. And I love listening to Dexter Gordon.
Well, when I first moved up to London in 1990, I worked at Waterstones Bookshop in Hampstead. I think I've told you this story already. And one time I was talking to a friend behind the till, and we used to open till quite late at night. 9 o'clock, possibly even 10 o'clock, changed a few times. And people would be in, you know, almost at sort of pub time, really, I suppose you'd call it. People would be browsing. And we used to put on sort of mellower music in the evening shift. And I said to a friend of mine, I might put together a bunch of Dexter Gordon's ballad recordings. That would be really good for the late night session. And there happened to be an R Price Records, which is now defunct, of course, but next door, the next shop. So I went in there thinking, I wonder if there's any Dexter Gordon I haven't got. And lo and behold, the ballads album was there.
Wow.
The collection, it was almost a synchronicity.
You're ahead of the curve.
So, well, I was behind the curve, but I thought I was behind ahead of the curve. Which is, you know, the story of my life. Story of my life. But and that's I think the two of the most lovely on that album, so obviously it contains other pianists, but... Guess I Hang My Tears Out to Dry is one of them, and Until the Real Thing Comes Along are two of the best for me.
Yeah.
And there's a Sonny does these really lovely introductions, doesn't he? That have, again, they slightly go back. It's almost like they slightly go back to the stride piano days in the sense of he's covering everything with his, you know, with his left hand voicing and his right hand lines.
Yeah.
But he's not obviously not going umcha umcha with the left hand, but he does sort of all the information you need is there, isn't it? There's nothing left out, like the rootless voicings of many pianists.
No.
And his solo is very fluid on this. It's Sonny's solo is excellent, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I sort of agree. I think, as we were sort of saying the other day, you know, the tragedy really of his life is that he was dead really within a year, you know, and when he was kind of, I mean, these later recordings, he was at the pinnacle, I think, of his playing, you know. And it's tragic, really, that, you know, he just didn't live to. I mean, I in a strange way, though, I mean, even though he had a very short career, I mean, he achieved so much, and I'm not sure how much more he would have, you know. You never quite know how he would have developed it had he have lived, whether it would have, you know, he would have developed more, or whether he would have even kind of gone into decline. You don't really know. But
well, it's difficult to know. It's difficult to know how any pianist or jazz musician in general who died in the 50s or 60s,
yes, absolutely, yeah,
would have fared in the lean period of the 70s.
Yeah,
for example.
That's true. Yes,
And people like Freddie Hubbard, who moved over to the funk side, you know, it's there are some trumpeters who don't really like that period of his playing. You know, they don't really listen to it at all. And you could say the same with Miles Davis. Some people don't listen to any of the electric Miles stuff.
No.
And just prefer the double bass over the electric bass period, if you like. So we don't know what Sonny Clark would have done given the interesting thing is that, you know, with that we're not talking about all these in between people so much, but that Don Wilkerson album that he plays on, he does play in a very funky style on that.
I mean, he definitely could have gone that way. He could have done that, you know, for sure.
And that might have been where he'd gone.
Where he would have, yeah.
Yeah, we don't really know. Well, I think that wraps it up for today. We've got a few things to, a bit of housekeeping, as it were, to talk about. So what's our next podcast going to be?
So the next podcast will focus on Sonny Clark as a leader. So he did record albums,
11,
under his own name.
In total, I think it was, I counted.
Yeah. So we're going to focus on those in a bit more detail. And talk about the players he worked with, and look into those in a bit more detail.
And that's going to really be primarily the Blue Note period, because that's when he made most of his leadership. I mean, he did do some trio stuff before, didn't he?
Yeah, we'll probably mention the trio stuff as well.
We'll probably lump the trio stuff together in one section. So we're now on Apple Podcasts. We've taken the plunge and got a plan that gets us onto all these different platforms, so you can listen to us on very many and varied ways. If you have your own favourite podcast app, we're probably showing up on that by now. We have started a Patreon page. For those of you who don't know what Patreon is, it's a thing set up to support the arts as a sort of charity ongoing giving option. And we're very grateful to our first Patreon, who's called Seth, who has signed up. And the money that he donates to us goes towards paying for the production costs of our podcast. And we are moving towards, which will be in December, publishing an ebook. And the reason it's that long away is because of tax reasons in Britain, where VAT will be removed from ebooks at that point. So it means that it makes it a lot easier for ebooks to be published without having to be VAT registered, etc. And we would like to say thanks to a few people who have been very kind to us and given us good comments. Pianist Rob Barron sent us both personal, he's a great bebop pianist himself, isn't he?
Absolutely.
And he sent us a very nice message saying that he hadn't heard or read of a more detailed document on the life and work of Sonny Clark, which we're most grateful for. Also, Mark Crooks sent me a message saying how much he enjoyed the podcast and it inspired him to dig out his Buddy DeFranco transcriptions and have a look at them. He did add a coda that they're bloody hard. and we'd like to name check Jimmy Merritt, who was a bass player on one of the Standards, or half of one of the Standards albums, really, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. With Sonny Clark, who died this week, who was had a very long career across many styles of jazz.
Yeah, and played electric bass as well.
Played electric bass.
Acoustic bass, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's all of our thanks. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think you've handled it very well.
So for this podcast, which was about Sonny Clark as sideman, I'm going to say, from Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And for me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.